Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, Lauren J. Sammons II, Associate Professor of Classics and Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University, will lead a discussion entitled Democracy, Ancient and Modern. He has written a book, What's Wrong with Democracy? Dean Sammons will speak about the history of democracy, particularly ancient Rome, and how the democracies of the current day can learn from the past. Introducing Dean Sammons will be Bruce Redford, Professor of English and Professor of Art History at the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University.
Good evening. My name is Bruce Redford. We're exceptionally fortunate this evening in having as our speaker one of the most dynamic scholars and teachers at Boston University, Lauren J. Sammons, Associate Professor of Classics and Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences. J. Sammons will be talking about democracy, ancient and modern, and I think I'm correct in saying that his remarks this evening will be derived at least in part from his new book, recently published by the University of California Press, called What's Wrong with Democracy. I sampled some of the responses to this book earlier today, and they include such adjectives as bold, unbridled, and marvelously unfashionable. And those three adjectives got me thinking. The result of those thoughts are two quotations, one from Edmund Burke's Reflections on the Revolution in France, which Burke writes, "A perfect democracy is the most shameless thing in the world." To paraphrase Bette Davis in All About Eve, buckle your seatbelts. You're in for a bracing evening. Professor Sammons.
It occurred to me after I agreed to do this that I would actually be introduced by Bruce Redford, which I understand is the closest thing to apotheosis that anyone can experience at Boston University. When I left Arkansas at the age of 21 to attend graduate school in New England, my father was convinced I would become a freak. In fact, I believe his exact words to me were, "Don't become some kind of damn academic freak." I had grown a beard at the time, which you see I've kept. And that was part of the problem. But about a year ago, when I told him I'd written a book called What's Wrong with Democracy, he concluded that his worst fears had been realized. His son was, in fact, a freak. Why write this book? Why write a book called What's Wrong with Democracy? Why get interested in such a crazy, absurd subject? I think you have to be either insane or really cranky to choose that as your topic at this point in world history. I mean, democracy is a word that we associate almost entirely with goodness itself, at least true democracy. Anything that's democratic that we don't approve of, we can somehow set aside as not being real democracy or true democracy. But true democracy itself is universally praised, almost universally praised. Now, I want to state at the outset that I perfectly well recognize that the United States is not a democracy, as that term was used in the 18th century. Everyone who's read the Federalist Papers knows that the founders didn't intend to make a democracy out of the United States, not a direct democracy. But I would argue that we have adopted a thoroughly democratic ideology in this country. And we talk about democracy as if it's an unmitigated good. We're certainly willing to spread it wherever we can, or say that's what we're spreading in any case. The values associated with democracy, freedom, equality, diversity, choice, these things are praised universally. To say something is democratic today is simply to say it's good. Regimes that we approve of, we designate as democratic. Regimes we don't approve of, we call undemocratic. Elections we like are democratic elections. Elections that don't turn out the way we like are undemocratic elections. The word has lost a lot of its content and has come to stand for something like good government or goodness itself. Well, that doesn't explain why one would ask what's wrong with democracy, although perhaps it should. About 12 years ago, 1992-93, the world celebrated the 2,500-year anniversary of the creation of Demokratia in Athens. Demokratia, the Greek word, obviously, that gives us democracy, combination of the two Greek words, demos and kratos, simply people and power. When a Greek said demokratia, he was saying something very immediate, people in power. Not a lot of conceptual content, at least at the outset. So Cleisthenes the Athenian had given the Athenians democracy in 5087, the Athenians believed. And so 2,500 years later, Greek historians around the world celebrated the creation of democracy. Not just Greek historians. There were conferences all over democratic capitals. And from these conferences came a spate of papers and volumes and a lot of interesting literature on the subject of Athenian democracy. One thing that seemed to me to tie many of these papers together, and I don't want to imply all of them, but many of them, was what I would say is an overly optimistic account of Athenian democracy. As most of the papers started from the premise that there was something good about Athenian democracy, and that we should try to find out what that thing is, and perhaps that thing can help us improve our own democracy. By studying at Athenian theory or even Athenian practice, we can somehow improve America's democratic regime. The problem that I saw with that was there was a tendency in these papers to ignore the events of Athenian history. Again, this wasn't true of all of them, but true of many. Events somehow got left out of the account of Athenian democracy. What, after all, happened in the 200 years that Athens had a democratic government? And, you know, the major events of Athenian history don't paint a pretty picture. The Athenians did, of course, defend Greece from the Persian Empire in the early 5th century. But having defeated the Persians, the Athenians took the league that had been founded to protect Greece from Persia, and they turned it into an empire, which they used systematically to exploit other Greek states for Athens' own material gain. The Athenians imposed their form of government, their democratic form of government, sometimes at the point of a spear on other Greek states. Sometimes, certainly, they did this because they feared the pro-Persian tendency of an opposing faction in that state. And maybe we think that's sufficient justification to overthrow a regime and put one in that we approve of. Certainly, the Athenians did. At other times, they seem to have thought that it was simply to Athens' advantage to have a democratic regime in power. Of course, the upshot of the 5th century democracy in Athens and this imperialistic policy was the 27-year-long war between Athens and Sparta. This is a war which Athens at the very worst accepted, and or at the best accepted, and at the worst, I would say, provoked with the Spartans, who had a sluggish foreign policy, not an aggressive foreign policy in the 5th century, as often the Spartans are often characterized as the aggressive power of the 5th century, which is simply not the case, as Professor Rothlob has pointed out. The warmongers in 5th century Greece sat in Athens and not in Sparta. The war with Sparta, 27 years, as I pointed out, a war of inconceivable length to the Greeks. No one at the beginning of the Peloponnesian War, except a few prophets, according to Thucydides, could have imagined that a war would last 27 years, an entire generation. That's not the way Greek wars were typically fought, which were usually short affairs fought in the borderlands between polises with relatively low casualties, resulting in relatively small exchanges of territory and then treaties for peace for 5 or 10 or 15 or 30 years. But this was a new kind of war, this Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta. And it resulted not, of course, in the victory of Athens, but in Athens' defeat. Athens, in 4043, at the end of the Peloponnesian War, lay literally prostrate before the Spartans. And the Spartans' allies put it to them that the thing to do with Athens was to do the same thing the Athenians had done to some of the states they conquered, which was to kill all the men and enslave the women and children. Now, had the Spartans done that in 4043 B.C., now, I'd ask you to ponder for a moment who would have been killed. The Thucydides would have been killed, certainly before he wrote much of, if not all of, his history. Socrates would have been killed before he had a chance to give the apology. Plato would have been killed before he had a chance to write anything. Demosthenes' grandfather or father would have been killed, so we have no Demosthenic orations. Aristophanes would have been killed after his great works and before his bad ones. So in that case, I think this would have been a good thing if they'd gotten rid of Aristophanes in 4043. The point is that the shape of Western civilization, as we know it today, owes much to the fact that the Spartans looked at the Theban and Corinthian allies and said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to execute all the Athenian men and enslave the women and children. There's some irony there that we can look to the Spartans as one of the reasons we have Platonic philosophy, I think. So Athens also, of course, was bankrupt at the end of the Peloponnesian War. They had spent the tremendous amount of wealth that they had accumulated in the 5th century, far greater wealth than any other Greek state had ever amassed. And, of course, that war led to the deaths of tens of thousands of Athenians and other Greeks. In the course of the war, the Athenians suffered two oligarchic revolutions. The Athenian democracy was overthrown twice, once during the war and once just after it, with Spartan support for that second revolution, I should add. And the Athenians, during the course of those revolutions, executed their own citizens. The Athenians executed their own citizens under the democracy, with some regularity, in fact. Of course, everyone knows that they executed Socrates in 399. You know, maybe as I.F. Stone argued, that wasn't such a bad thing. I mean, after all, he was an anti-democratic guy, really an annoyance who ought to be gotten rid of. That's not my view, and I don't think it was Plato's. And in the 4th century, of course, the 4th century history of Athenian democracy culminated with Athens' defeat at the hands of Macedon, first by Philip of Macedon, Alexander's father, and then Alexander's successors, who ultimately placed an oligarchic regime in power in Athens and into classical Athenian democracy. So that's not a pretty picture, I would say. Less than 200 years of free government, two oligarchic revolutions in the course of those two centuries, a long war that spread death across Hellas, and in fact you could argue that the Peloponnesian War was the reason for the decline of Hellas in the 4th century. Not a pretty picture at all. There are reasons that the 5th century critics of Athenian democracy and the 4th century critics of Athenian democracy thought democracy was a bad thing. The reasons that Plato and Thucydides and Aristophanes and Aristotle had problems with democracy. It's not that they were fools. Were they biased? Did they suffer from all kinds of biases inherent in being a Greek of the 5th or 4th century BC? Of course. Well, I think they did. But that doesn't mean they were wrong. They looked at the world around them and they drew some conclusions about Athenian democracy. Not all the conclusions were right, I don't think, but they had reason to conclude that there was a problem there. Now, I want to make it clear that there are many reasons to admire Athens, and I don't want to be seen as someone simply trying to trash the memory of the great Athenian state. Athens deserves to be remembered for its contributions to philosophy, for its contributions to history, for its contributions to architecture, art, literature, all these things make Athens worthy of our admiration. And for those reasons, Athens has been admired for 2,500 years. It wasn't thought until the 20th century that we needed to convert the Athenians into some kinds of forebearers of modern democracy to admire them. We can admire them for all those other reasons, and I think we should. I would say that our obsession with Athenian democracy says more about us than about Athens, after all. We treat democracy as something like a moral value, an end rather than a means. And as I've argued, the 5th century Athenians, anyway, didn't seem to think too terribly much about democracy, not theoretically in any case, different in the 4th century. But they certainly weren't obsessed with it the way we are. So I'm trying to help modern Americans look at Athens and look at ourselves a little more clearly by trying to break free of our pro-democratic biases. What, after all, do we really value? Is it democracy? Is that the thing we're most proud of as modern Americans? Is that the thing we really want to spread to the world? Do we reinterpret now things that were once seen as goods in and of themselves as things that will further democracy? I remember I read a famous political scientists who said private property is only it can only further democracy when ownership is widespread. In other words, private property is not a good thing in and of itself, he implies. It's a good thing because it furthers democracy, and then only under certain circumstances. So what makes democracy work seems to be the question that such thought asks, not whether democracy is a good thing. I remember driving into Boston 2 or 3 years ago and seeing a huge sign. Maybe some of you saw it on the Mass Turnpike. It was a sign for a local college, and it said in huge letters, "Education is the glue of democracy." And I thought, well, that's an interesting way to tout education. Well, it's a good thing that it's the glue of democracy. Otherwise, we might not think it was good at all. Education is the glue of democracy. I heard someone a couple of years ago say that the vote is my most sacred act. The vote is my most sacred act. Is the vote sacred? Is it the thing against which we gauge good citizenship today in America? I think it is, actually. I mean, are there any other things that you can publicly criticize someone for other than not voting? I mean, you can upbraid someone to the end of the earth if they admit that they didn't vote. The only other things I can think that come close to it are smoking cigarettes and driving an SUV. Either one of those things can get you in trouble in polite company. But not vote. I remember standing in line for a commencement ceremony here at BU a couple of years ago and talking about this with a colleague and, you know, saying something like, well, I don't think the vote is sacred, and I think it's a perfectly reasonable position for someone not to vote. And the person behind me, one of my colleagues, literally grabbed me and spun me around and said, are you saying it's okay not to vote? And then she proceeded to tell me why I was wrong and a bad person for saying those things. And I tried to explain, well, this is a book that I'm working on, and this is, you know, you're sort of doing the very thing that I'm talking about here, but that mattered not at all. Someone who doesn't vote, smokes, and drives an SUV is in big trouble in modern America. So I'd like to give two sort of concrete examples of problems with democracy, with Athenian democracy, and I'll start with voting itself. I mean, that's really the core anyway, isn't it? I mean, voting is the thing that we seem to associate most closely with democracy. Now, one interesting thing about the Greeks and voting is that Aristotle didn't consider it democratic. And it would have been odd for him to consider it democratic because all Greek states who didn't have tyrants voted. I mean, Greek states that we know anything about voted. The Spartans, at the other end of the political spectrum from the Athenians, many would have it, voted. They voted whether or not to go to war with Athens. The difference between Athens and Sparta was who made up the citizen population, who got to vote. But the idea of voting itself being associated with democracy wouldn't have made sense in a Greek political context. And what Aristotle says about voting is that it's really an aristocratic element of government, because the thing with election is that it tends to produce wealthy rulers. That election is a way to ensure that the wealthy will rule, not to ensure that the people, the demos, will rule. I know this is shocking. We, of course, have seen that this is not the case. And we hold elections, and we realize that the wealthy do not tend to get elected over and over again. So I think this is a way we can see that we've really advanced over Greek politics. But they didn't see it that way. The thing is, though, that all the mistakes the Athenians made were made after a vote. After the majority of Athenians present in the assembly held up their hands and said, yes, I think that's what we ought to do. The good thing's the same. I mean, the decision to fight the Persians at Marathon, that was taken on a vote, I'm sure, as well. But I want to look at one particular example of the way voting caused problems in Athens, and this has to do with public finance. I'll try my best not to bore you with the subject of public finance. Around the middle of the 5th century B.C., the Athenian statesman Pericles proposed that the Athenians should be paid to serve on juries. Now, the Athenians' court system relied on very large numbers of jurors brought together by the hundreds, 200, 500, 1,000, 1,500 jurors. And Pericles stood before the Athenian assemblymen and proposed that the Athenians should be paid for serving on these juries. Not surprisingly, his motion passed. Good idea, Pericles. Yes. Why didn't anybody come up with that before? Let's all be paid to serve on the juries. Terrific. Now, One of the reasons Athens was able to do this was because they had a very profitable empire at the time. They also had silver mines in the Athenian state, which made Athens, even without the empire, an unusually wealthy Greek state. But this seems to have been a real change in Athenian policy. Now, we're going to allow and encourage the poor to participate in this regime by serving on juries, by paying them to do so. Now, you won't be surprised to know that by the end of the 5th century, all Athenian magistracies were being paid, as far as we can tell. The Athenians weren't just being paid to serve in juries. They were being paid to serve in the council. They were being paid to serve as ambassadors. They were being paid to serve as magistrates. I mean, after all, if you're an Athenian politician and you see Pericles succeeding by proposing that the Athenians should be paid, how are you going to make your name in the Athenian state? Are you going to do it by standing up and saying, "Pericles is wrong. You should not be paid"? Huh? What is this guy talking about? Doesn't he know we're already getting paid? If you want to get ahead in the Athenian state, I would put it to you in the 5th century, the way to do it is not to propose no pay or less pay, but to propose more pay or different pay. So you propose that the boule, the council, should be paid, or you propose that ambassadors should be paid, et cetera, et cetera. So it quickly became, I think, impossible for an Athenian politician of the other viewpoint to succeed in Athens. You simply couldn't get ahead by going before the Athenian people and saying, "I think we're paying you too much. We need to pay you less. We need to restrict the amount of magistracies or the offices that are being paid. We simply, can't go on this way. It's leading to financial problems, etc." That kind of argument wasn't going to fly in 5th century Athens. So how do you stop this? How do you stop payment for public service once it gets started? Well, the only way the Athenians found was revolution. The revolution, one of the oligarchic revolutions, the one in 411 BC, one of the basic tenets of it was we're not going to pay people to serve in most offices anymore. Of course, that was a failure for all kinds of reasons. After the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians eventually decided that people should be paid to vote. And when people ask me sometimes, "Well, when you look at Athenian history, what do you predict for the future of America?" You know, I always prophesy, you know, that Americans will be paid to vote someday. Or if they're not paid to vote, at least they will be given a vacation day. You know, it'll be an official vacation day. Get people out of work. They get paid to not go to work. And hopefully they'll vote. But something to sweeten the pot for voting. So the Athenians were paid for voting, and eventually they were paid to go to the theater. They received a theater subsidy. A few obols to make it possible for you to go see the festivals. And, that's a great proposal, too. Can you imagine the guy standing in front of the Athenians and saying, "Well, this is a whole voting thing. Sure, pay you to vote, but what I want to do is I want to pay you to make it possible for you to attend the festivals." Great idea. Excellent. So what does all this tell us? One thing, I think, is that democracy tends to breed best-case scenario thinking. Best-case scenario thinking is thinking like, we have the money to afford this now, and we probably always will. We have a nice empire now. We've got silver mines that are pouring money into the state now. And so let's propose something that we hope and think we will be able to afford forever, even though we understand that once we get it on the table, it's going to be hard to take it off. I think we see the effect of entitlements on public morale and debate, that once a populace believes and has become inured to the idea of receiving something from the state, it is incredibly hard to take it away from them, and they're unlikely to vote to have it taken away. Is it any surprise that modern politicians promise more spending and tax cuts, even in the face of an incredibly expensive war? And I would just add that even the proposals that are floating around now for fixing, quote-unquote, Social Security don't really address the issue of whether we can afford Social Security or we'll be able to afford it in anything like its present form, but rather look to repair it somehow for the future. Americans and our leaders, I would say, like the Athenians, are unwilling to face harsh financial reality, and we're all too likely to vote ourselves into bankruptcy. Okay, that's negative example one, so let's look at another. Let's talk about foreign policy for a minute. I've got to sort of set the stage here for Athens in the 350s BC. So we've got to fast forward now past the Peloponnesian War into the 4th century BC, when the Athenians were still powerful, but not nearly as powerful as they had been in the 5th century. In 378-7, the Athenians had created a league against Sparta this time instead of a league against Persia. And the Athenians opposed Spartan hegemony in Greece for some time. But by 370, 8 years later, the Athenians were actually allied with the Spartans against the Thebans, who were members of the league against Sparta. So this is what 4th century history is like. It gets a little confusing. The Athenians had founded this league against Sparta in part by promising the other Greek states that they wouldn't do what they'd done in the 5th century. We won't take lands in your cities the way we took lands in the 5th century. We won't impose tribute payments on you as we imposed tribute payments on you in the 5th century. We won't force you to come to Athens for your legal cases and have your cases heard by Athenian juries as we did in the 5th century. No, we're not going to do any of those things. But in fact, by the 360s, the Athenians were collecting a form of tribute from some of their allies. They were imposing, taking lands in some allied states. And so it's not surprising that by the 350s, a group of Athens' allies revolted, and the Athenians fought the so-called social war, a war between socii, between allies, between 357 and 355. So that's point one. Between 357 and 355, Athens is fighting a war against her allies. All right? Now, at the same time, something odd was happening north of Greece in Macedon. Macedon was a second-rate power at best throughout classical Greek history up to this point. Rafe Seeley, a very eminent Greek historian, has said that when a new Macedonian king came to power, the Athenians need pay no more attention to it than a king in a comic opera. That's the kind of characters who ruled in Macedon. A banana monarchy, Seeley calls Macedon. And it had played a minor role, a marginal role in Greek history. But the Greeks were really unclear on whether the Macedonians were even Greeks in any case. The Macedonian ruling party, ruling class, did speak Greek. Modern scholars don't even agree on what the native language of Macedon was. And the general attitude was that the Macedonians are something like hillbillies, extremely backward folks. They don't live in polises. They don't practice political life the way the southern Greeks do. But in 360 or 359 BC, Alexander's father Philip became king of Macedon, and he swiftly changed the situation. The first act Philip took after defeating the real hillbillies, as I'm sure he would have called them, who lived north and west of Macedon and had been harassing Macedon for a long time, was he moved east and he grabbed the mining region in southern Thrace. Now, that mining region was crucial to Athens' foreign policy, really from the 6th century all the way to the 4th century. It was one of the few areas, along with Athens, where there were precious metal resources. And Philip was no fool. By grabbing those precious metals, he made himself formidable economically and able to afford the kind of army he was going to need for his plans. But Philip also took several other areas in northern Greece. You'll see the city of Amphipolis there in just south of Thrace. Amphipolis was a city that Athens had founded in 437. They had lost it in 424 BC, and they never regained it, but they claimed it all the time. Amphipolis to Athens was a prize that they must have again because it was the gateway to the mining resources and to timber supplies. And if you want a great fleet in antiquity, as Bob Strasser will tell you, you need timber supplies and money. And so Amphipolis was important to the Athenians. Philip took Amphipolis in 357. Philip took, you'll see several other cities there, south and west of Amphipolis. You see Pydna, which was held by the Athenians. Philip took that. He also moved eastward into Thrace and began to push toward Athens' interests in the Chersonese, modern Gallipoli. You see that spit of land there that runs along the Hellespont. The Hellespont was really the other leg of Athenian foreign policy in the 6th, 5th, and 4th centuries. The Athenians were desperate to control the Hellespont and to have influence in the Chersonese because their grain supplies came out of the Black Sea. So the point I'm making is that when Philip impinged on Amphipolis, Pydna, and the Chersonese, he was in fact touching what had been crucial to Athens' image of their own power and security up to this point. But the Athenians were distracted during these years to some degree by the social war, by the war they were fighting with their allies. So it's a little shocking that even in 355, when the social war ended and the Athenians essentially lost that war, that the Athenians still didn't take any radical action against Philip, no real forward policy against Philip. Philip eventually moved toward, I should say that Philip in 352 made a feint towards southern Greece all the way to pass at Thermopylae, where the Persians, of course, had been stopped briefly by the Spartans. So there was no doubt after 352, or little doubt, that Philip might have interest in southern Greece since he tried to grab Thermopylae. And the Athenians, in fact, had to send a force up there to prevent him from taking it. But also in that year, 352, Philip began to impinge on these three peninsulae here called the Chalcidici. The Chalcidici just south of Amphipolis. There was a league of cities there, Greek cities. The head of that league was a city-state called Olynthus. And Olynthus in 352 or so made an alliance with Athens, an alliance which the Olynthians hoped would protect them from Philip. That was the point of making an alliance with Athens. Athens was the great sea power in the Aegean at this point. And so when Philip began to encroach on Olynthus and the Chalcidian League, the Olynthians sent to Athens and asked for help by terms of their alliance. And this is the moment at which Demosthenes really first appears as a political force in Athens. Because Demosthenes made speeches in Athens in which he said to the Athenians, "We must spend money to protect Olynthus. And you Athenians must be willing to serve in the army yourself. We can't just send mercenaries. Mercenaries are not getting the job done. We need large citizen forces, and we need large amounts of funds to fight against Philip in the north." Now, the problem with Demosthenes' proposal was that it required moving money from the festival fund, the fund that actually paid for Athenian theater tickets, to the military fund. And by this point, the Athenians had actually cordoned off their festival fund so that it was very difficult to make such a movement. And Demosthenes, in proposing that this money get moved from the festival fund to the military fund, found that he got no traction, as they would say in modern politics. It was impossible for him to get the Athenians to go along with moving that money. And in fact, the Athenians sent small forces to Olynthus. They did not prevent Olynthus's fall to Philip, which happened in 348. And I would say that the effect of Olynthus's fall was great on Athens' reputation. Because now the Athenians found themselves in an interesting situation. If they seek allies against Philip of Macedon, what reason do those allies have to think that Athens will protect them? I mean, after all, they didn't protect Olynthus. So why in the world would you ally with Athens at this point against Philip of Macedon? Now, in these same years, 348, 347, Athens was engaged in a series of negotiations with Philip. One of the most vexed problems in Greek history, these negotiations that preceded the peace treaty of 346. And because the only way we know about these negotiations are the speeches of Demosthenes and Aeschines, or this is the main way we know about them. And Demosthenes and Aeschines spent most of their career calling each other horrible names and insulting one another's mothers, literally. It's very difficult to reconstruct what actually happened. But it was something like this. One party in Athens, a faction in Athens, seems to have been led by Aeschines, Demosthenes' bitter rival, claimed that Philip is not such a bad guy. He's really not after Athens at all. We can trust him. All the nice things he says about Athens ought to be believed. Sure, he came down to Thermopylae in 352, but he's really not such a bad guy. And we ought to make peace with him, basically on his terms. Demosthenes opposed peace with Philip, it would seem, initially. Eventually, he came to the position that Athens should actually make a treaty with Philip, but it should be a treaty that included Athens' other allies. That is, we have to force Philip to agree to protect our other allies, the most important being a city-state Phocis in central Greece. There was another politician, Athenian Eubulus. Eubulus apparently told the Athenians during these negotiations, he told the assembly that we either make peace with treaty, we make peace with Philip on his terms, or you Athenians better be willing to march down to the Piraeus, the harbor, right now, get on the ships, pay the war tax, and give up your public payments. Give up your theater tickets. That was the way Eubulus put it to the Athenians. Peace with Philip, or fight and give up your payments. The Athenians voted for peace. They voted for peace on Philip's terms. Apparently, some Athenians, maybe even Aeschines, thought that still Philip might come into central Greece and not harm their allies, the Phocians, even though Philip had been at war with the Phocians before. But Philip marched into central Greece, and he actually destroyed the city of Phocis, Athens' most important ally at this point. The Athenians had also hoped that the king of eastern Thrace, Cersobleptes, would be included in this treaty. Philip had not included him in the treaty, and in fact, ironically enough, Philip had already taken Cersobleptes' kingdom by the time the Athenians read the plea from the king to include him in the treaty and responded, no, we're not going to. It was a fait accompli at that point that the Chersonese was already really in Philip's control. So what's the upshot of this? After this peace treaty, Athens' strategic position was severely undermined. Other states were not likely to listen to Athens where alliances were concerned, as we saw already with Olynthus. The Athenian politicians fell into recriminations with one another about who was actually responsible for the Peace of Philocrates. Aeschines blamed Demosthenes for it. Demosthenes blamed Aeschines for it. Philocrates, the poor sucker who actually had his name on the law, eventually was indicted and fled less than 3 years after the Athenians had passed his motion. He had to flee Athens for his life. Eventually, the Athenians actually smashed the stone pillar on which they had inscribed Philocrates' peace treaty. In the late 340s, the Athenians did take some action against Philip. Still, though, they refused to vote to move monies from their theater fund to their military fund until 339-8, just before the Battle of Chaeronea. The Athenians finally made that crucial vote to move those monies to the military treasury, but it was too late. The Athenians stood with the Thebans against Philip at Chaeronea in 338, and they lost that battle, of course. I would just add that Chaeronea is often treated as an inevitable defeat for the Athenians, as if the Athenians and other southern Greeks had no way of defeating the Macedonians. The Macedonians had 30,000 men at Chaeronea. I find it a little hard to believe that the southern Greeks, who were capable of defending themselves against certainly much larger Persian armies, were not capable of standing against 30,000 Macedonians. Maybe they wouldn't have ever won that battle, but we simply can't say. The reason we don't know is because Athens didn't act soon enough to put together the kind of coalition that the Greeks put together against the Persians. And if Athens wasn't forward enough in its policy where Philip was concerned. Why? Because the best-case scenario message was, we can keep paying ourselves, and we don't have to serve as frequently in the military as we have in the past. Philip is probably a good guy, so we don't need to plan for him not being one. Best-case scenario thinking. So, not so good. So what's the solution? I'm not calling for a revolution in the United States and the overthrow of a democratic or republican form of government. In fact, I'm trying to argue that thinking about democracy and politics as a solution to our problems already shows a kind of corruption, that we have so much faith in democracy today that we look to it to solve all our social problems. We expect to be able to solve society's problems through the vote or through our political leaders. But I'm not so sure that that's the way to solve society's problems. I think instead of democratizing the non-democratic elements of our regime, as one group of ancient historians called for, we might need to appreciate the non-democratic elements of our regime. Citizenship, one, and the rule of law, that the will of the people is perhaps not a moral force and shouldn't be considered one, that there are other things that should guide us in our individual lives and in our public policy. So to try to point that up, I'm going to say a few positive words about Athens and the idea of citizenship. What can we learn positively from the Athenians? This is one of the things that makes Athens and indeed the Greek polis in general most admirable. The Greek city-states clearly believed that the citizen had a responsibility and duty to other citizens and to the state. They believed in those duties and responsibilities rather than rights that were protected by the state. Athenian citizen duties were onerous. When an Athenian stood for office, he was asked several questions that he had to answer publicly. He was asked, "Are you enrolled in a cult of Apollo and Zeus? And where are the altars? Do you worship the gods?" He was asked, "Do you take care of your parents?" And I find this an incredibly telling question. The Athenians asked their fellow citizens whether they took care of their parents. They assumed they took care of their children. Well, everyone takes care of their children. The mark of a good citizen is whether he takes care of his parents or not. Do you take care of your family? Do you fulfill your obligations to your family? They also asked them, do you pay your taxes and serve in the military when called? Do you fulfill your obligations to your fellow citizens? So that's the structure of an Athenian's public obligations, obligations to gods, obligations to the family, and obligations to the fellow citizens and the polis. Just to look a little more closely at this, between the age of 18 and 20, the Athenian youth served as a kind of home guard, a little military training. This is certainly by the late 5th century and in the 4th century. After the age of 20, you might hope, well, if you're an Athenian, you're out of the military, but no. You were liable for military service in Athens probably until you were 60 years old. Certainly into your mid-40s, you were going to be called up to serve in the Athenian military. And in the 5th century, that meant you were going to go to war almost every year. Now, because the Athenians went to war almost every year in the 5th century. Of course, the Athenians who served in the infantry, hoplites, who were liable for the service, are only the middle class and above. Those below the middle class were not liable for this service. But the poorer Athenians often chose to serve in the Athenian navy, where they rowed the Athenian warships, or triremes. This was a nasty business, rowing triremes. If you've ever seen the beginning of Ben-Hur, you have some idea what it's like to be in a trireme, literally pretty much in a hot hold, waiting for the bronze beak of some other warship to ram through the side of your vessel. Hopefully you'll be able to swim and not separated from your breathing parts by some sharp bit of iron from another vessel. So a good part of the Athenian citizenry was engaged in warfare most years in the 5th century. Taxes, well, Athenians paid land taxes only after about 428 B.C., but after that they paid them fairly regularly. Again, only landowners obviously paid land taxes. Most Athenian citizens served on the council for one time in their life. The council was year-long service. You might think of it as a kind of congress of Athenians who came from all over the Athenian state and put in their year as a councilman. They were selected by lot, by the way. Lottery was a mark of democracy as far as Aristotle was concerned, not election. That you want real democratic government, you choose people by lot. Taking care of their parents, I've already mentioned. Other moral and family obligations. Athenians could be prosecuted for prostitution, seduction, hubris, that is, dishonoring another citizen. Religious obligations I've already mentioned. Economic obligations of an Athenian citizen. Well, if you wanted to maintain your property qualification, if you wanted to stay in the middle class, as it were, you had to keep your farm up. Your farm had to produce a certain amount of goods each year to maintain your property qualification, to maintain your standing in society. It's true by the 4th century, the Athenians don't seem to have paid much attention to these property qualifications, but they certainly did in the 5th century. Athenians also were prevented from squandering their inheritance. Interesting law, a law against squandering your inheritance. and could be prosecuted for having done so. Wealthy Athenians, of course, were liable for various public services like funding theater performances or funding a warship for a year. So in return for all these duties, Athenians received certain privileges. What were those privileges? Voting? Yes. Performing these duties, you got to vote. And that meant something because, of course, you got to hold up your hand and decide whether you wanted to march out that year as a hoplite or not, whether you wanted to risk your life in battle, because you knew holding up your hand meant very likely that you were going to actually serve. It's a sobering fact to realize that the Athenians, who voted to send themselves to war, did so on a regular basis in the 5th century B.C. Jury service. Yes, you got to serve on juries and earn pay by doing so. As we see from Aristophanes' Wasps, that the senior citizens in Athens considered this a real boon. Since they didn't have Jerry Springer and Oprah Winfrey, they could go downtown every day and watch someone on trial for his life. And not only do you get to see this drama, but you actually get to participate in it, voting not only for guilt or innocence, but actually whether to execute the character or not. This was real entertainment. You got to hold office, whether by election or lot. And you got to serve as an advisor to the people. You could stand up in an Athenian assembly and propose measures or seek to advise the Athenian people. So I would say there were real privileges in return for real duties. Now, what do we require of modern citizens? What duties do we have to fulfill as modern citizens? Jury service? I seem to recall a few people in my life telling me that they were called up for jury service, but they managed to get out of it somehow. Very proudly telling me this. The funny thing about jury service is that since I've been teaching at BU, which is about 12 or 13 years now, I've never once had a student try to get out of his jury service when he was called for it. Students are incredibly diligent about fulfilling their jury service. They come right to me and say, "Professor Sammons, I've been called for jury service, and I must go. I will miss the midterm exam." Excellent citizens are students. So jury service, maybe. Voting, well, we've already gone over that. We know that you must vote to be a good citizen. You absolutely must vote to be a good citizen. You at least have to say good things about voting to be thought a good citizen. It's disturbing to find out that only 49 to 60% of the population has voted in the last in the presidential election since 1992. Between 49 and 60% of the American populace has voted in presidential elections. Forget about the others. Between 92 and 2004. The question I ask is, do we really value our citizenship? Do we value it precisely as much as it costs us? Is that the price we put on it, which is basically nothing? Now look, many of you may be thinking, I'm sure you are, thank God we're not burdened by the Athenians' concept of citizenship, and that we've realized that citizenship is about rights and not about duties. I feel that way myself. I mean, who doesn't? But I think we should remember that 4th century Athenians seem to have come to something like a similar attitude. 4th century Athenians thought, you know, we don't really need to serve in the military as much as our fathers and grandfathers did when we can hire mercenaries to do it for us. Demosthenes has a chilling passage in which he describes the kind of army the Athenians ought to put together to fight Philip. An army for pay that will use guerrilla warfare is quite shocking. There's no need to give up our public payments because even though the military is underfunded, you know, things will probably work out. You know, Philip may not be as bad as some people say. So let's continue to pay ourselves to vote and to go to the theater. No need to plan for the worst, Re Philip, you know, when hoping for the best is so much easier. So, what are Athenian history's lessons for us? As far as Athens' success goes, to the extent that Athens succeeded, we must attribute much of that success to Athenian society and to material and historical factors that had little or nothing to do with democracy. I wish I had more time to talk about those things, but I'll just emphasize one again. The Athenians had silver mines. They were the only state in Greece that had a massive, ready source of wealth, and that made Athens different from every other Greek city-state. It was those silver mines that allowed Athens to build their first fleet. It was the first large fleet. It was the silver mines that allowed the Athenians to defeat the Persians in 480. It was the silver mines that allowed the Athenians to create the fleet that created the Athenian Empire. So we can't lose sight of the fact that those mines made Athens different from other states. How about Athens' failures? To the extent that Athens failed, I think we must admit that her democratic practices contributed to rather than prevented that failure. Americans today, therefore, I think, cannot satisfy themselves. We cannot satisfy ourselves with the thought that we're spreading or defending democracy without contemplating the type of society we wish to perpetuate and spread. And I think asking ourselves, what historical factors have led us to the position we're in right now? And what historical factors have led the other states that we're involving ourselves with to the position they are right now? Looking back, that is, rather than simply looking forward. Now, are we, after all, going to offer the world and value for ourselves merely the vote and free market capitalism? I remember talking with my father once, and he said to me, "Well, as soon as we get television and McDonald's over there in Iraq, everything will be fine." I said, "Pops, that is Osama bin Laden's argument." That's his argument you're making. That's a good one. Do those things, the vote and free market capitalism, ensure or encourage better fathers, more trustworthy neighbors, more dutiful citizens, or more courageous leaders? Do they offer us better ways to treat the very old or the very young, stronger families and churches? If indeed democracy is the good society itself, as at least one theorist has said, democracy is the good society, then we have no fear. But if it is, instead, merely a political system and ideology, and one that threatens to generate its own values rather than relying on or protecting pre-existent values, if democracy or any successful regime requires a strong social matrix built on non-political values to survive and prosper, then we have reason to fear. Athenian history warns us against placing our faith in democracy itself, and warns us not to forget the concepts of shame, duty, and citizenship that bind together a successful society, and it is a warning I hope we will heed.
You've been listening to Lauren J. Sammons II, Associate Professor of Classics and Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston University, talking about democracy, ancient and modern. He's written a book, What's Wrong with Democracy? Dean Sammons spoke about the history of democracy, particularly ancient Rome, and how the democracies of the current day can learn from the past. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Matt Odette, with help from John Perotti. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.